nothing to eat. These people were astonished, and so they asked, verse 44, Lord, when did we see you hungry and did not take care of you? Then he will answer them, truly I say to you, to the extent you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it unto me. The majority of people present on the judgment day will not have lived during the time that Christ was here on earth, and therefore will not have seen him as he was. No wonder that they will ask, when did we see you hungry and did not take care of you? Jesus' reply is a sobering revelation to all of us if we'll take it to heart. He said, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. Brethren, in our daily walk through life, you and I often see Christ Jesus, but we don't recognize him because he appears to us as the half-starved, ragged, sickly man slowly ambling down South Cumberland Avenue. As we hurry past, determined to make it the yellow light at Tennessee Boulevard before it turns red, we just glance at this poor guy and think for all of 3 seconds how pathetic he is. Speeding under the traffic light just after it turns red, we think, I've just got time to get home when supper is served. This weary, hungry, forlorn man struggling along on the sidewalk is quickly forgotten. In the back of our mind, we quickly dismiss him with this conclusion, he's not my problem. But folks, he is our problem, because we have just passed a representation of Jesus and totally dismissed him as a pathetic figure who has no relation to us. We do it every day. And what will we say in the judgment when Jesus looks at you and me in the face and says, I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat? Folks, you may be thinking I'm over-dramatizing, which I cannot do because I'm not a dramatic person. And you may be satisfied that you can just let all this leave your mind before noon today. But brethren, if this is not what Jesus means in Matthew 25, I would love for you to tell me what it is that he does mean. There was a time that I want to tell you about, that I was seeing Jesus 5 times a week, sitting directly in front of me, growing thinner and weaker every day, and I took no note of it. But someone else did and took effective action to save this young girl from collapsing. This special perceptive man, I'll never forget. No credit is due to me in this story that I'm going to tell you, except perhaps this, that I remember it accurately and can relate it to you this morning, is what I hope will be a very good example. So let me take a little while to tell you about this utterly true story. But I would preface it by saying this first. We now take food for granted. It is a ubiquitous presence at every time, in every place. We can't do anything without eating being a vital part of it. Any kind of gathering must have that table of drinks and cookies. And if someone is really trying to impress us, they'll load the table down with several types of crackers, cheese, chips, and dip, little meaty things floating in delicious gravy, and all other kinds of munchies and aminuchies. So we meet and eat. We greet and eat. And we all get a little heavier and a little thicker. The typical American adult today is about at least 30 pounds heavier than his counterpart a couple generations ago. And where it's going to go from here, I know not. Obesity has become a prevalent health problem. I must sadly admit that in the last few years I've become overweight. I hope it's not too far beyond the upper limit. We won't discuss that any further, though. But in this setting of food glut, it was unthinkable what I witnessed one year when I was teaching at Stratford High School in Nashville. When I made out the seating chart for a particular class in early September, I placed a girl named Stacy in the first seat in the middle row, right directly in front of my speaker stand, where I stood most of the time then and taught. She was a healthy, well-proportioned girl with sparkling eyes and rosy cheeks. She was not a high achiever in math, but she did hold a solid B average, which in my class was pretty good. She seemed happy and well-adjusted. To me, she was just a typical teenage girl. So I didn't pay particular attention to changes that were gradually taking place in her. They happened like the moving of a shadow during the day as the sun traverses the sky. You know, you don't notice a shadow moving when you're looking at it. But if you look at it at intervals, you will take note of its change in position. Seeing Stacy day after day, I paid no attention to a process of change that was taking place in her. One day in February, our guidance counselor, a man named Bob Knox, called me out of class and asked, "Mr. Whited, have you noticed how Stacy has changed since this school year started?" When he provoked me to think about it, I realized that indeed a lot had changed with this young girl. Because it had happened gradually over the 6 months or so, I just adjusted to the creeping changes without paying particular attention. But challenged to compare the present with the past, I was brought to realize what had indeed taken place. Stacy's clothes now literally hung on her loosely. Her face had sunken in. Her cheeks were no longer rosy. She no longer smiled. She seemed to have withdrawn from her classmates into a sphere of isolation. I had noticed that her grade had dropped from the B range down to the lower C, a C minus or so, but she seemed preoccupied, like she was already always really, really worried about something. "Well, perhaps she's taken up the use of drugs," I told Mr. Knox. "That would account for the weight loss, the social withdrawal, the changed disposition, and her declining grades." I don't know, he answered. My heart tells me that she is not using drugs and that there is some other serious problem that is really afflicting her. So he decided to call her into his office and talk to her in private, hoping that he might find some answers and get this girl help she desperately needed at that point. At first, she just sat silent and stared at the floor as he gently talked to her. But each day when she could and he could, he called her into his office and continued these sessions. And finally, after several days, he gained her confidence, and then Stacy began to open up. And as she did, she laid out a situation at home that was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, we just couldn't relate to it. You see, Stacy's family at home consisted as follows: herself, her parents, and an older brother who had dropped out of school. All of them but Stacy were highly involved in the use of drugs and alcohol. Her brother every night brought in one or two other boys just like himself who sprawled out on the furniture and got stoned, spaced out, as they said back then, and drunk. They were grimy, filthy-minded, sewer-mouth boys. Stacy was greatly afraid of them, and as soon as she got home from school around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, she immediately went to her bedroom and locked herself out in and did not come out into their presence. She thought that if she did, at the least, she would be subjected to very rude language, and at the worst, she would be groped and very likely assaulted. She would not go to the table and eat, such as her pathetic mother might have fixed. All she was eating was a meager amount in the morning before she left for school, when everyone was laying around deeply asleep after hours of intoxication. Mr. Knox was keeping me informed about what he was getting in these sessions with her, and I was thinking about it daily. And as I thought about Stacy's starvation in a food-saturated environment, I could not help but remember the lines of the English poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge in the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner: "Water, water everywhere, and all the boards did shrink. Water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink." Food was all around Stacy, everywhere, but it was not available to her. She had no money to buy anything at school to eat, and a lot was sold in the cafeteria and throughout the day. And she was too humiliated, I suppose, by her wretched family to ask anybody for anything. As we filled our faces every day all around her, she looked longingly while hunger gnawed at her stomach and her face shrunk. You see, because we stayed continually satisfied and more beyond, we were insensitive to her needs, thinking we're all alike in this. When Mr. Knox heard all of this, he reported it to the Department of Human Services. When they investigated and found that it was true, they removed Stacy and put her in a foster home, but still in the Stratford school district, or the Stratford area. So she kept coming to school, and I saw her daily. A reversal in her condition soon became apparent. Within a few weeks, she gained weight. Her sunken face filled out to its original pretty form. Her cheeks became rosy again. Her grades climbed back up to the B level. She was provided with a full new wardrobe. Her worn, faded, tattered clothes were thrown away that she had been wearing. But because of the emotional trauma that Stacy had experienced, the sparkle did not return to her eyes. She did not take up smiling again. She did not develop social interaction with her classmates. I suppose that she felt different being in a foster home, a ward of the state, without a family who loved her and supported her. Within the context of a large, crowded public high school with many problems, I mean many students who had their own pressing problems, we'd done just about as much for Stacy as we could do. We saw that she was removed from the scene of continual danger, given plenty of food, adequate medical attention, and provided with good, decent clothing to wear. But folks, those are only the necessities for staying alive and being physically comfortable. Life also has an emotional, psychological, and spiritual dimension, which in the long run is even more important than the physical. That dimension we in public education were unable to give Stacy. I do not know what finally happened to her. After that school year ended, I never saw her again. If she's still living today, she'd be in her mid-50s. I seriously doubt that she was able to go to college or pursue vocational training, though she was well able to do either. About a decade later, a daughter was born to me, and I was careful to see that she was given all of the advantages of a full, happy life that Stacy never knew. Any teacher who is worthy of the name feels, at least to some extent, that each student he or she has is their son or their daughter. This is an aspect of the agape love that Christians are taught to develop in imitation of the Lord they worship. My own actual daughter is one whom I was able to give a good, well-adjusted life. Stacy was a daughter in this other sense, to whom, because of many barriers as a public school teacher with overcrowded classes, I could give precious little. Folks, you might think, and be writing this off in your mind as you're hearing it, that this was an isolated, extreme, rare case from years ago, and conclude that it has little relation to us today. And if that's the case, I've wasted our time. Folks, if that's what you're thinking, you are totally wrong. It's true that this case did happen many years ago in inner city Nashville. But here's the reality. Cases like this are in progress every day of the year in great numbers throughout our society right here in Lebanon. Most of us know very little about them, except occasionally when a very sensational case is reported on the local TV newscast about the man, homeless man, that was found dead over here just off of the square a day or two ago. Perhaps all of us here this morning, and most of the time, are at least middle-class Americans. We live in good homes where we're safe, where we have all that we need to live comfortably and be reasonably happy. When we do have a problem, we can usually get help soon and recover. This is especially true in a church family such as we have here, where so many respond immediately and generously to any case that is reported. But folks, that only touches the hem of the garment. There are people all about us in this city, within hundreds of feet of this building, especially right behind me, to whom we pay little attention. People who live in wretched homes like Stacy's, where they're not safe, where they have poorly fitted, worn out, ragged clothing, who lack good, nourishing food. Many of them, if they're not fed at school, public programs, wouldn't get much food at all. You know, the gospel of Jesus teaches us clearly that the Lord requires a lot more of us than piety, pure worship, and loving those who love us. By word and personal example, Jesus teaches us to be compassionate and helpful to those who are destitute and hurting. In Matthew 5, 46, 47, Jesus said, "If you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax gatherers do the same? And if you greet your brothers only, what are you doing more than others do? Don't the Gentiles do the same?" Jesus' use of the verb love here is much broader than our common meaning. When you look at somebody and feel a resulting inner warmth and lifting of your spirit so that you smile and feel good, you think, "I love that person." Folks, that's only the beginning of Christian love, just the beginning. Because Christian love proceeds to reach out to the person you're loving with action that blesses them and improves their well-being. The inspired James points out that true faith factors into the work of love. Consider the message, James 2, 14 through 17, that Brother Rick read to us a minute ago. "What use is it, my brethren, if a man says he has faith, but he has no works? If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, be warmed and filled,' and yet you do not give them what is necessary for the body, what use is that? Even so, faith, if it does not have works, is dead, being by itself." Faith and love work together to help us to be perceptive to the basic needs of people around us, not to speed past them at 50 miles an hour and just glance and think how pathetic. It should motivate us to give that needy, hurting, suffering, lonely person hands-on relief to improve their situation. You know, when we pray to God to help somebody, there's something I fear we're leaving out of the prayer that's essential. We get a call or a notice, "Pray for so-and-so," and we do it. And then you put a period right there. That's the end of it. I prayed for them. I've done my duty. Folks, when we pray for someone's alleviation of suffering, do you put this in your prayer? God, use me as an instrument to get your help to that person. That I fear we do, not most of us. A prayer alone, as James says, go in peace, be warmed and filled, doesn't require much love and much faith. Love and faith is apparent when you put your hands into it and really do something. Brethren, there are great many Stacys not very far from us who are isolated, lonely, unloved, uncared for, hungry, sick, poorly clothed. We could talk about that for an hour with information from various sources that would make it very real. Will you and I, as I was with Stacy at Stratford High, just be blind to these people and let them continue to suffer so that as long as I feel good and things are going for me, everything's okay? What will we say in the judgment if Jesus says to us, I was hungry, you gave me nothing to eat? Remember, we see Jesus in just such people as that teenage girl in Nashville who was starving to death before my very eyes, and I didn't see it. Always keep in mind as you enjoy the good life that there are so many around you that are destitute, and that Jesus said, to the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. I can anticipate someone coming to me and say, well, what about you? What are you doing? Folks, haven't you seen guilt dripping out of every pore of my sermon this morning? This is something we all stand in need to look at, reevaluate ourselves, and get these hands busy really helping people, directly doing them some good. If you're here this morning and need to respond to the invitation of the gospel, we bid you come as we stand and sing.